shadow dances, I am still. Peace is my companion. Joy is my friend. The campfire, the stars, the slight breeze, the taste of the hot chocolate, and the dancing shadows are, in themselves, enough. Here I am. Why waste time wanting to be somewhere else? Join me by the campfire.
Hello, everybody. Thank you so much for joining another episode of Campfire Philosophy with J. Aaron Simmons. I am joined tonight with here at the campfire with two of my very close friends, Liz Seaman and Seth Kane. And we are ostensibly having a walk into the bar sort of conversation. Walk into the fire seemed a little bit too hot. And I didn't want the pastor, to start shouting heresy and stuff. So tonight we have a philosopher, a politician, and a pastor walking into a bar, sitting down by the campfire, having a conversation, and hopefully modeling what it looks like to do the kind of discourse that is all too rare in our contemporary social environment. So before we dive in, tonight is a little bit different. It is not live streamed. So all of you watching, hopefully you'll be watching this Monday night as it goes out live to all of you. We recorded this a couple days ahead of time. And the reason is because I hopefully will be on my mountain bike shredding down some trails at Snowshoe Bike Park while this is being played over YouTube. So there are not any ability for us to take your comments tonight. I apologize about that. But if you've got any thoughts, any questions about any of the stuff that we talk about, you can always drop comments there on YouTube or LinkedIn, and it allows me then to come back and engage you individually in those spaces. You also can always reach out to me at simmonsphilosopher@gmail.com. And you can basically, reach out, whatever I can do, feel free. And then also drop by my website, jaaronsimmons.com. And it has lots of resources and ways to get in touch with me so that we can keep the conversation going. So let's get going tonight. I'm so excited. Quick introductions. Liz, we've known each other for about 13 years, I think. You are the chief of staff for the Furman University president and have worked for decades in nonprofit work, Meals on Wheels in particular, I know you did a lot of work with. And you also have been, since 2008, a member of the Greenville County Council. And so I am exuberantly thrilled to have you here. If any of you are interested in Liz's political campaign, here's a QR code. I know she would love to have your support. And then also I'm going to throw up a link throughout the night to her fundraising she's doing for the Cancer Survivors Park. And so both of those great causes, make sure you check them out. So Liz, thanks so much for being with us tonight.
Thanks, Aaron. Great to be here.
And our other guest by the campfire is a mountain biking friend of mine and fellow Florida State fan, Seth Kane. He is the lead pastor over at the Village Anglican Church in Greenville, South Carolina. Here's a link to them. I know they would also love for you to check it out and see about the amazing things they are doing. And Seth and I met years and years ago when I actually dropped in, visited one of his former churches where he was pastor. And though I didn't start going to that church, we found out that we both are Florida State fans, and a friendship, of course, that's all it takes. It's like the, Breakfast at Tiffany's song. It's like, I think we liked the film. Maybe that's enough. So being Florida State fans in South Carolina is enough for a friendship. And so since then, we have spent, many, many, many hours and many miles on mountain bikes together. And so, Seth, thanks so much for joining us tonight.
Yeah, it's my pleasure. It's great to be here.
So let's just dive in tonight with a broad question that will maybe help us kind of lean into a variety of different issues. The reason that I wanted you both to join me is because we are told by, our parents and any reasonable person, don't talk publicly about religion or politics. And this idea seems to be anchored in the notion that when we talk about religion and politics, people get very angry, they get very heated, and it makes, personal relationships fraught. They get really hard to navigate. And yet, Seth, you talk about religion, you identify in ways that are trying to bring religion to public spaces. Liz, you are a politician, which means at some level you are doing politics as part of your just existence. So let's start with you, Liz. what does it mean for you to be a politician in the context of that grandma's advice, don't talk politics? How do you navigate that reality?
Yeah, sure. Well, Aaron, I think it's interesting, and maybe a little fun fact you didn't know about me. When we lived in Louisville, Kentucky, I was the youth director at our church, and I actually contemplated going to seminary for a while.
I did not know this.
So for me, I see what I do as a calling. Nowhere near as important as what Seth does and others who are in that space, but a calling nonetheless. And so I think I try to view it as, I mean, kind of my mantra has always been, I'm trying to figure out where my gifts and strengths meet the needs of the community. And so for me, it just so happened that, you know, politics was an option. Although, you know, I prefer to say public servant, but because I think politics has become such a dirty word now too, but I do think it's also interesting to me. And I don't know if also if it's a Southern thing. You know, when I lived, you know, my trajectory has been Chicago, Cincinnati, Louisville, and here, because I wasn't really in the space when I lived in those other places. I don't know, but I do think there's something about the South. We're polite and we want to be nice to everyone. And the way to do that is to not talk about things that could be controversial. And I think what it's done has really hindered our ability to have hard conversations, especially with people who we're already friends with. I mean, you know, everything is based on relationships. And so you would think the place where it would be most comfortable or most safe to have some of those conversations should be around a dining room table when you're breaking bread with friends. But it's turned into something taboo.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's fascinating. I had no idea that you had that youth pastor background. I do, as a lifelong Southeastern resident, I love the fact that you've kind of made your way down here, you know, and so your trajectory is the right one. Having also lived in Florida for a long time, though I'm a Florida State fan, I think Greenville, South Carolina is about as far south as I want to live.
Same.
It's just way too hot and not enough seasons. Camping is really miserable in Florida. I've done it. I don't want to do it again. I'm glad that you've made it down here. But I think you're right. The politeness can be both the thing that is so charming and warm about, you know, Southern identity. It also can be the thing that then creates a kind of facade whereby real engagement, nuance, depth is not stuff that we're comfortable doing because we are actively wanting to make sure that we're only really warm with the people who are, you know, kin, right? They're part of the family. Seth, you also, I know, have spent a lot of time in the South. You're religious in the South, but you're also Anglican in the South, which is a little bit different than, you know, the Pentecostals like me or the Southern Baptists. So how is it that you've navigated this sense of being religious in a context that is supposedly the Bible Belt and yet maybe makes us really bad at thinking and talking and living in relation to religion?
Yeah. I mean, I think Liz is on to something about, you know, our unwillingness to step into difficult conversations, politeness in the South. I think religion and politics both present things for all of us that potential problems or complexities that we can't solve. And they are, when we're spending our time often with people, that can feel like it costs us more than it gives us. I think probably the three of us would say, no, it gives us an enormous amount of energy and moves us in ways that it feels important, even if we're not solving any of the problems. It's an end in itself to be talking about it. But for a lot of people, and I think this is true as I interact with my parents, and my in-laws, and friends, and parishioners, and others, it's taxing. It's heavy when you feel like you're talking about things that you don't have a lot of direct agency in. I mean, we're living in a state where your vote effectively is, except for maybe at the local level, it may not seem to count or other things. Yeah. And so it can feel a little bit discouraging and withering in those kinds of ways. But as far as just being religious in the South as it pertains to these things, I think, you know, everyone is political, everyone is religious in one way or another. I think some of it is kind of owning the fact that these are things that we do care about. These are things that work themselves out in lots of different ways. But you do need to feel like you can talk about it in a way that is welcome. And I think whether it's the politeness or maybe it's just the challenge of knowing that you can have opinions and you're in a safe environment to, and you know, safe is thrown around a lot of different ways, but like that hey, this could be fruitful and productive without diminishing the relationship. I think fewer and fewer people are feeling like that's as possible as it used to be, like that people will not take it personally, you know. And this is not a slight in any way, but along with that politeness, there's also, I think, more of a broad scale kind of reality that as our culture becomes more and more therapeutic, you're trying to really be careful that the things that you say and that you do are not interpreted as being offensive or being, you know, are being highly polarizing or what have you. I just think people maybe are on one end not careful enough, and then on another end they're too careful. So, and you know, I could say a whole lot more about the Bible Belt and sort of everything from evangelicalism to, you know, nationalism and Christian nationalism in particular, and how it works itself out in the South. But it's created just an environment that's hard, I think.
I mean, I think about when I first ran in 2008 up until now. I mean, social media, there are a lot of good things about it. I love seeing pictures of cats and everyone's children. And today was first day of school. I love seeing the first day of school. Sure. But the ability of people to just either take something as the gospel truth without doing their own research, or immediately misconstrue, or, you know, repost something, or, I mean, it has completely changed the landscape of how I engage with my constituents, and even just how, I don't know, it's just sad to me. It draws out the worst in people, and especially those who claim to be Christian.
Yeah. Well, y'all are hitting on an issue that almost all of the questions that came in ahead of time from some of my subscribers about this episode, almost all said, so how then can we, you know, take seriously religious identity in deliberative democracies without thinking that a particular political vision and a particular religious identity just are the same thing? And in most cases, they were saying, you know, in many spaces, you know, being Republican just means being Christian, or if you're a Christian, well, how could you dare vote Democrat? These sorts of identities sometimes can be presented in ways that minimize the very agency that democracies ought to be fostering, right? And I even suggest that Christianity should be fostering, or any religious tradition. Mm-hmm. And I'll give you an example of why I think this is so tricky. The political philosopher John Rawls suggests that the only way we can engage as real equal citizenry is if we do so according to what he calls public reason. And there's lots of objections to this view, but the simple idea is I can't deploy reasons and expect my, you know, fellow community members to access those reasons if they are located within the determinacy of my religious tradition. Because let's assume, Liz, that, you know, you're Muslim and Seth, you're an atheist, and I start quoting the Bible. It's not that that's inappropriate in a democratic space. It's just that it can't count as a reason for the two of you, and ostensibly the things that should motivate us when it comes to shared social life should be anchored in reasons that we all can access, we all could consider, and we can then offer objections to if we don't think they hold up, right? Mm-hmm. And so Rawls suggests deploying religious reasons in this sort of process of social thinking actively cuts against the equality of the citizenry, because it's necessarily going to elevate the voices of those who can access those reasons. So if I'm quoting the Bible, the other Bible accessing reason givers, they've now got special access to this conversation in a way that other people might not. So what this might yield are moments like at the recent Republican National Convention, where the senator from the state of South Carolina, Tim Scott, was basically preaching a kind of Pentecostal sermon, right? You know, talking about Satan coming to Pennsylvania and the lion showing up and, you know, God still works miracles and all this sort of stuff. And I saw several friends of mine who are pastors posting saying, isn't this amazing? Our politicians are stepping in where our pastors, you know, fear to tread. And I responded to my pastor friends. Again, I identify as a Christian. I said to them, yo, maybe this should worry you, because the very things that you might be terrified if this was, you know, someone who had a different religious tradition doing this sort of work, you would immediately think that's not okay. What about all those members of our society who don't share the Christian tradition? Isn't this kind of an exclusivist gesture? Isn't this problematic? And I got a variety of responses. One pastor deleted my comment and told me don't do that anymore on his page, right? So I don't know if we're friends anymore. We'll figure that out. But what do you all think? And Liz, I'm especially interested in your view on this, because as someone who, you know, has religious identities that is part of those communities, and also somebody who represents lots of constituents who are not religious, how do you see the way that these religious, you know, influences ought to then speak into our public discourse? Or is Rawls right? This is important. You can do it. It's just not going to be good when it comes to increasing equality and maximizing voices.
Yeah, Aaron, I think part of the challenge is the difference between what we're seeing at a national level or even a state level and then a local level. I might argue that what happened at the RNC and what will probably happen at the DNC, they are speaking to a really specific audience, and they have no desire to really go outside their scope of the people who are in the room, who are the Uber Kool-Aid drinkers, and the people who are watching are either the Uber Kool-Aid drinkers or they're commentators or pundits who do it for a living and they have to watch. You know, they're not speaking to the people who are maybe on the fence trying to make a decision. And that has, I think, everything to do with media, social media, the people we have running, how things have evolved. I mean, even think about all of the, every time they go to rallies, everything is orchestrated. And so I think it's very hard and probably more incumbent on us as local officials to try to narrow the scope down to, okay, I mean, that's that. But what we're talking here is, you know, do we have enough sheriff's deputies on the road to make sure that our community is safe? And if your house catches on fire, do we have enough firefighters, and are the roads safe enough so the fire truck gets to your house and saves your family and keeps your house from burning down? And that is just, it's just such a huge chasm. So I don't know. It's hard, and it's hard as a local official, like, to either not be caught up. I mean, our issues are people issues. So there should be the least amount of politics here locally. And sometimes it seems to be magnified as the most politics are here local, because people can run into me at the Publix or at work, or I have a slew of really not great emails that I get just about every morning of people who don't like the decisions I've made. But there's definitely a difference between sort of the national stage and the local stage.
That's really, really helpful. Yeah. What do you think, Seth?
Well, I think that's right on. And I call myself uber local, hyper local in the sense. And I think the church is at its best when it understands, you know, like in our tradition, we call it a parish, which is connected to the idea of the particular, like it's here. And there's even an Anglican bishop, contemporary one, N.T. Wright, who made, you know, is quoted as saying, if it's real, it's local. And I think maybe he wasn't the first to say it, but he was saying like this, where it really works itself out is here, is in the local. When you've got to actually be in relationship with someone, you've got to actually try to solve problems together. You've got to confront the realities together, live together, et cetera. Social media is a non-space. And to a great degree, I think these conventions and the process, the, you know, what they can get up there and they can say is really primarily to make people feel a certain way. And they are, you know, it's abstraction in a lot of ways, and it's kind of just unhelpful. They've made these kinds of spaces to sway people's thinking. They've made it in a space where it's really just signaling to others, make them feel a certain way, make some promises, rally the troops and all of that, and use the language, signal with that language to simply really not to ultimately make promises that it would intend to deliver on, but to just win the vote as an end in itself. And I do think that's at the national level, we're just caught in a cycle of getting people elected, but not necessarily really dealing in the issues that people are facing every day. And I think it's disingenuous to use religious language just simply because, you know, other people relate to it. And I'll say this, the kind of rhetoric that comes through that really, really bothers me, whether it's on the left or the right, when religion is invoked or ideology is invoked, is it's moralism. It's a, most of what it is not simply, it's not care. It's not trying to deal with the problems of humanity. It's not mutuality. It's moralism. It's you do the right things, or we're doing the right things. They're doing the wrong things. Don't be like them. Be like us. And that is not actually the message of Christianity. It's fundamentally the opposite of the message of Christianity. And again, I think on both the left and the right, they are, whenever it's invoked religiously or again, a heavy ideology, it is a form of moralism. And that's exactly what brings out the worst in all of us. Because not all of us, I think deep down, know we can't live up to it. But yet again, you've got politicians saying, we're going to live up to it and be the exemplars of this. Why don't you join us and be that too? Right. And it's, again, it just puts it, it's a non-reality. And again, redoubles itself in social media, which is a non-space. It's just unhelpful.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. Oh, absolutely. And the thing that I think both of you are pointing toward is the narrowing, or might even say the you know, winnowing out of the audience at the national level. And yet you're saying, Liz, like, but at the local level, there are real problems. Are the streets wide enough? Are the bikes, you know, having enough space to ride where they're riding? Or do we have a backup in this one place? My goodness, the train tracks going to Wade Hampton High School. Like, we're now experiencing this. It's a disaster. Like, the realities of how do we make very practical things better? This doesn't depend on radical division. And in fact, division just gets in the way of getting stuff accomplished in ways that are largely going to be popular among members of a community.
Right.
What though has your job as a local politician, and the same question to you, Seth, as a local pastor, has that gotten more difficult, more challenging? Do you have to be on your toes more, given that what's coming down from the national space and in so many ways dictating the way that we encounter each other at Walmart is so divisive that it's not just I disagree with this other person about some complicated issue of social life. It's I can't see this other object as person because we disagree about this issue of social life. Like, how has that changed since, you know, 2008 for you in the role that you play?
Yeah. So I think a couple of things, it's that whole, why can't we disagree without being disagreeable? And it's just turned into like, just, it's impossible to do. And I think Seth, what you were saying too, just speaks to, it's convenient to use the language. You know, but you got to really do the hard work. I think the other challenge that I find with all this, and again, I'll go back to something I said earlier about it's about relationships, but it amazes me the number of people that don't know who their local elected officials are. They can name all the people at the top of the ticket, all the people they see on TV, the ads and all that kind of stuff. But when you say, you know, oh, well, you live off of Wade Hampton, do you know who your county council member is? And I mean, when they say no, it's like, I mean, that's what makes it hard. If you have not even figured out who your person is, much less, like, especially for the county council, the municipalities have it a little bit easier. They're a little more hyper-focused on neighborhoods and things like that. But, you know, what our body does and the fact that we're set up as single member districts. So, you know, we each all have about 40,000 folks who put us in office. This last primary, 17% of the people voted. Some of my colleagues won or lost. One of my colleagues won by like 25 votes. I mean, it just, there's so few people making the decisions.
Yeah.
And I think Seth, you said this earlier when we started too, in a lot of states, and ours is one of them, the primary is where it's at, because come November, there's either nobody on the ballot on both sides of the ballot, or the way the districts are drawn, it's pretty skewed one way. And there are other states that are skewed the other way, but it just, it would be interesting to think about, is there some sort of systems change for that piece of it? But I think just people's inability to really develop relationships and understand the various roles. And that could go for county council, could go for school board. I mean, even the people who serve on our boards and commissions here too. I mean, people are just so, I mean, I think about everything that's been happening with our library board. People are very quick to rush judgment about things without even understanding the process, understanding governance and what people even have the purview over. I mean, we could do a whole podcast just on that.
That's right. It makes me think about the fact that I think individuals have internalized the performative nature of, even what we were talking about with Tim Scott or whomever, any given, national politician, such that they don't know who their local people are, or even how they might go about affecting the local problems, because they are kind of reflecting back that performative, well, I believe in this and strongly, and this is my identity, or I wear the t-shirt, what have you. Mm-hmm. It's kind of from that level, it's a garbage in, garbage out kind of a thing. And when in fact, what we should be able to do, and it's harder because people are spending their time in these non-spaces, not to keep harping on it, such that they're not spending their time locally and engaged. And they're happy to just simply, and this is beyond the performance, this is kind of the second thing, they're to assign or to accept or to understand their identity with regard to who I might vote for at that level or identify with, what that group is, when in fact not actually, again, because they're kind of performing, not actually having to engage in the local problem or the reality, use their agency and all of that. They can just have a strong opinion, they can talk about it, they can decide who's like them and who's not without actually doing the work. But that's the culture, that's the environment we've created. I think it's part of late stage capitalism, where people are just a product of the ideas, and that's, my big problem with the way even identity works in our culture right now is that it's just such a shallow, skim the surface, performative kind of, affect of who we are, and not actually a deep sense of our situated local relational way of being and of maturing and growing and doing the things that are within our scope. And the last thing I'll say on that too is, like, I talk to people a lot about, and to really back to your original question, like, how has it changed? I find myself bringing people back to these two concentric circles of concern, big concern, and small responsibility. And maybe you guys have heard of this, but like being able to identify, like, what is within, what can I do something about? What is within that sphere of responsibility? What are the things that I, like, where my vote really counts, and also what, maybe nobody else can do but me, like, this is my responsibility. There's a lot I can be concerned about. In fact, increasingly the culture tells me I need to care about this, that, and the other thing. But if you live with your life constantly directed by that larger sphere of concern, you're probably going to obscure what you can actually do something about. But that is what our culture tells us we should be doing, is aiming at everything and hitting nothing. Yeah. And so that's changed, I think, dramatically. I think it's changed both in the way people even go about relating to the local relationships in church and being involved in knowing Liz Seaman's name, and partnering with her,
Seth, do you think there's a inverse relationship or I'm thinking about, even in my own congregation, our numbers have ebbed and flowed, and even post COVID and really not getting back. I'm wondering what you see as the connection between, like, has the ugliest of politics risen as church membership and attendance has dropped? Is there some connection between the two?
Yeah, I think the connection is that we have, in some ways, both consciously and unconsciously eroded our just civic connections, and those, that local connection. We've eroded institutions that help people feel a sense of belonging and all of that. And I think, And the church is one of them. And I think part of it is the church, we've sawn off the limb that we're sitting on by probably becoming too overtly, I don't know, in conflict with others, a lot of us and them, binaries and things like that. But I think it's just simply that we don't, I think that we don't, aren't able to be as focused on and as concerned with the people we're around because our lives are lived so diffuse and not, I mean, we just are so disconnected. And again, it may sound like a conservative talking point, but it really is true that we have eroded not just the family and its value, but also just our connection to our extended families. And some of that is just by nature of being able to live wherever we want all over the world and see our families a lot less. And the church is just in some ways one expression of that same thing. Before COVID, the amount, I mean, people attended who said they were members of or regularly attended church, it was 1.8 Sundays a month. You know, you look at that a lot of different ways, but the truth is you're not really, really connecting to those people. And so you have you already have such a kind of loose relationship anyway. And then you insert into that political strife and difficulty. And it's like, you might be more inclined for it to be 0.8 as opposed to 1.8, you know, and on a scale in that direction. And then, yeah, so I do think there is a relationship, but I think we were already moving in that direction when we have just gotten so diffuse in general. Mm-hmm.
So Liz, I'll speak personally, you know, as my sociology friends remind me often, two anecdotes do not count as data, Aaron. So here's a single anecdote that does not count as data. For me, even as somebody who writes and researches and thinks and speaks about religion and philosophy of religion a lot, church has become nearly impossible for me. Now, my family still goes. We think it matters that my son be raised in a space where some of the traditions and heritage that is passed down from, you know, my grandfather, that's stuff he can also understand. And again, for what it's worth, as a Pentecostal, unless you grow up in it, it will always just seem effing crazy. So there is a reality of like, I want him there on Wednesday nights. I want him playing drums at church. I want him to be part of this community. And it was super important for my wife and I. We met in youth group. Our whole relationship was anchored in me playing drums and her singing and traveling and doing all of this sort of work. So I think there's so much good that is possible in those spaces. But it is true for me that when church became hard, it was, and again, I'll speak very, very personally here, disclaimer, I need a QR code to pop up and say, you know, no views represented here are shared by everyone else. But when evangelicals seemed to abandon the very moral commitments that they had invested me with when I was a kid, love your neighbor, care for the poor, you know, reach out to the immigrant, you know, be invested in neighbor love as the fundamental model of what it looks like to be a person of integrity. When all of that kind of went out the window because, oh, I can't vote for Clinton, so I guess I'll just abandon my moral commitments and vote for Trump. Like for me, that was a real hard thing to get over. Not because, notice, we disagreed about politics, right? But the reasoning was not, I think these policies are problematic. I think this is going too far in one direction. We've got to rethink what it looks like to navigate freedom and equality as two social goods. And where does the balance lie? It was no. I can't vote for that person. So my morals be damned. Onward toward the very thing that I was raised to see as a problem. And then when COVID came around, it was like, oh, if there was ever a high hanging curveball for neighbor love, that was it. And what I experienced was far too many churches, not all, let me make clear, but far too many churches way more concerned about their own ability to do the things they wanted to do and not caring about neighbors as the fundamental mode in which we, you know, are the church. And so I watched what I would describe as, you know, the church whiffing at balls that should have been home runs. Care for your neighbor. Actively invested in their health, whatever that looks like. Yes, we can disagree about policy. Should we shut schools? Should we not? This is hard stuff. But don't act like people who are doing their best to listen to medical personnel are brainwashed idiots. Like that became the next step beyond where I was comfortable being in that community. And so though I love my pastor, I'm still part of a church locally, I don't go as often as I once did. And it's because this is a space that actively does not represent what it is that I take to be the message of other-oriented love modeled in, you know, Christian traditions. So I do think that going to church is harder for me now because, you know, things like thinking we should feed children in schools become liberal issues. And, you know, trying to find ways to help teenagers not kill themselves becomes, oh, you're an extremist radical because you're trying to rethink gender. It's like, I may just be trying to love my neighbor, right? So the fact that our divisive rhetoric has overwhelmed our ability to see the face of the other has made church really hard for me. And in fact, this morning I was painting this house across town and I had not met the guy who lived there. I had been working with the woman and she and their kid. And anyway, she had to leave. So the guy was coming down. He works from home. And so he comes down and introduces himself to me. And somehow we got into a conversation about God and politics, which again is not what you want to do when you're halfway through painting his dining room. Right? Because is he going to kick me out of the space? Is this going to go really bad? Am I going to walk out because I can't be in his house? But it turns out that he said to me, you know, I still think I identify as a Christian, but I don't really go to church anymore because what I was taught as a kid just isn't what I see in churches. And it was that same experience. So here we are, two anecdotes, don't count as data. But I think there's something to that sense, that palpable sense. I don't have to agree with everything, even theologically, to be part of this community. We do have to agree that we're going to care for the widow, the orphan, the stranger. And I'm not sure that that's the way an awful lot of churches understand themselves. And I do think a lot of it has been fostered by the divisive rhetoric occurring, you know, at national political levels. So I don't know, Liz, if that, it's not an answer, it's just my experience.
Yeah, no, I think for all of us, no matter what our calling, occupation, vocation, we can't give up. I mean, I think that's the other thing. I think about that a lot in my role here, and there are certainly days that I'm frustrated. I was frustrated that I'm, you know, losing some colleagues, but I'm gaining new colleagues, and I'm trying to remind myself they ran for the same reason I ran, because they want to make a difference, I hope. The way they campaigned might be 180 from the way I would campaign, or words that I would say, or tactics I would use. But I still have to work with them. There's only 12 of us. And I think the same with the church. I mean, you know, to your point, you're never, ever, ever going to agree with your minister 100% of the time. I almost think it would be weird if you did, because I feel like we're there on Wednesdays or Sundays or whatever day to be challenged, to be moved, to have some feeling inside of you, whether that's agreement or anger or motivation to do something. But I think the worst thing that any of us can do is just say, you know what, I'm just done. It's just because it's easy. That would be the easy path out. It would be easy for me to say, you know what, I'm not going to run again. It's too hard. People are mean. Like, I'm tired of getting the phone calls and the emails. And I'm, you know, I'm tired of people saying things about me or my family. But if I do that, then they win. Then that those folks win that. And I don't know. I just even on the worst day, I know that I am making a difference. And there are people out there that have my back.
Yeah. And you know, it's easy to, I'll say, to in your role and in mine, to have the voice of the detractors or of the critics rolling over in your head constantly without being able to really see and centralize that, hey, there are lots of people who are with me and who care about these things deeply and who are willing to live with nuance and tension to be able to keep moving forward and who want to stay in the game. And I think, you know, at Village, that's a big thing. Like a lot of people are at our church and we were sort of their last ditch effort to be connected to a church, a place that where they could disagree and where they could, I think to some degrees, be identify as refugees from a lot of the things that the church has become, and not to escape so much as it is to rest. And I think that is one of the things that we do need to be able to do at church is to rest. It needs to be, we say it even needs to be churchy. It needs to feel like you can come out of a lot of that tension and stuff. And you need to be able to come out of a lot of the withering kind of stuff that's out there and just hear good news. I mean, that's the novel thing. I mean, to your point, Aaron, I mean, it should be good news. I mean, again, that doesn't, and to Liz's point, I mean, sometimes it's challenging. I mean, Jesus above all things, not above all things, but along with all the things about him was somebody who was an equal opportunity offender, you know? Mm-hmm. And so I think, I don't know. I'm kind of musing sort of loosely now, but I think church should be a place where we can hold that kind of, you know, attention there and realize that, hey, we can disagree because what we do have in common is that we are deeply loved. Even if that person does, I'm not feeling a lot of love coming off of that person. We're held, you know, Aaron and you and I have talked about that, but like, I mean, we're all so, embattled in a lot of different ways and we have a lot of self-doubt and insecurity, but what the gospel does say is that, you know, it's Jesus who has initiated this thing and he's actually going to hold us. You know, I'm preaching on John 6 this Sunday and what he's saying is the Father has called me to hold together everything that he's given me to the point of eternal life. Like, and that's incredibly good news and that should foster a kind of insecurity that honestly allows us to talk about anything, to confront our differences, fight well, to fight for each other, and to realize it's hard. I say this, we say that at our church all the time, it's hard to have a body. It's hard to be human. Yeah. Like, can't we do that together? It's hard to be a nation. It's hard to be a city, you know? And so I think that's just, I don't know. I'll just put a period right there.
I think it's a good period. So we're going to take a very quick break here from PlankSip.com, our sponsor of Campfire Philosophy with J. Aaron Simmons. We'll be right back. And I want to dig into how the two of you bear the mantle of this responsibility of representing more than your own view. And then we're going to also talk a little bit about some practical steps. What are ways that we can maybe make things a little bit more compellingly social in ways that might be a little bit less, you know, kind of hot-bloodedly political. So we'll be right back. Thanks for hanging out. See you at the campfire in a second. I hope you are enjoying Campfire Philosophy. I would like to take a moment to thank PlankSip for sponsoring the show. Daniel Sanderson is the guy behind that media outlet, and he is a fellow lover of philosophy. So if you get a chance, head over to PlankSip.org. That's PlankSip.org. If you sign up for their ideal plan and use the offer code Aaron, that's AAron, you will get 50% off for the first 6 months. Free book publishing and lots more. Go check them out. And thanks so much to Daniel and PlankSip for sponsoring Campfire Philosophy. Now, back to the show. Yeah, I just always want to take a second to thank Daniel Sanderson. PlankSip.org is doing absolutely amazing, amazing work. Anybody who goes there to see the stuff they're working on, you want to get involved, make sure you use the discount code Aaron or Camping. Either one will work. You get 50% off their ideal membership. And so do check out PlankSip.org. Amazing, amazing work in public philosophy. So we're back at the campfire with Liz and Seth. And one of the things that I wrestle with a lot as a professor, whether philosopher or not, as a professor is this responsibility that I've got, you know, remove 20 students or 35 students, or my goodness, you know, even at Furman, you know, we've got 2,500 students total, that at some level there is this sense of obligation or responsibility or felt need to be invested in who they are becoming, how they are living. I'm not able to make them virtuous. I am trying to invite them to reflect well about what virtue might involve, right? So a question came in from a friend of mine named Jimmy, and he was like, how is it that pastors and politicians navigate and bear the reality that they are making choices for other people's freedom, right? So Liz, when you decide, you know, whatever it is, we're going to put a shopping mall there, or we're going to hire more police people, or we're going to have to raise taxes, or whatever the issue is, there will be some people who think, brilliant, about time, and other people who think, this is awful, no, 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 no. And of course, in our representative model of democracy, that's kind of the breaks. But how do you, as the person making those choices, weigh and consider the reality that you're not just choosing for yourself, but you are making choices that might have real, felt, and in some cases, difficult situations become even more difficult for some people? How do you navigate that?
Yeah, that's a great question, Aaron. I think first is starting with the realization and the humility that I do not have the answers to all things. I'm not an expert in all things. And that's one of the biggest challenges of serving, is that there's so many different facets of things we talked about. I mean, you just mentioned economic development, you know, land use, public safety, infrastructure. I mean, very complicated issues. And so part of it is I need to come to the table remembering that I don't have all the answers, and I seek answers from people who are experts in that field. And I do my best to weigh all of the data, the pros and the cons. Mm-hmm. And I count on my constituents to also give me feedback. And, you know, I also think so sometimes, to your point, sometimes I will have groups that will agree and sometimes they'll disagree. You know, people sometimes will ask, well, like, what's one of the hardest things about your job? One of the hardest things is being in a room full of people who want you to vote no, but you know that the right answer is yes.
Yeah.
Because not only, I mean, I've got to represent my district, but I also have a responsibility to think holistically about the entire county. And yeah. I do think one of the benefits I have, not only just the background and experiences and lived experiences that I bring to the table, but even with a few years under my belt now, understanding the full ecosystem. And I think that's the other challenge. Sometimes people take a one issue thing and it's just yes or no on that one thing, failing to truly comprehend all the different pieces of the puzzle. You know, I think affordable housing is a great example of this. Some people are, yes, we should do affordable housing and it's important and government has a role. And some people are like, absolutely not. You know, we have no role in that to play. But if you believe like I do that housing, transportation, green space, those are all roads, all critical parts of infrastructure that play into economic development and the importance of having a continually growing community that brings good jobs, and well-paying good benefits to our market, then what happens is those folks become active in their churches, in their schools, in their communities. They become philanthropists. They give, they lead the company. I mean, it's just this cycle. And so that's a long way of saying is I definitely do my best to try to see the big picture, but also to remember that I don't have all the answers, and also to know that sometimes I'm going to get it wrong, and that's okay.
Yeah.
Well, you sound, shall we say, very philosopher adjacent with the idea that humility is the condition of truth seeking. One of the things that I have as a philosopher grown tired of would probably be the easiest way to say it. Downright exhausted and want to put my head through a wall might be more accurate, is the anti-intellectualism and the distrust for expertise in fields where expertise is, you know, rightly recognized, right? Seth, we're going to come in a second to, so how do you get to claim things about expertise when it comes to God, right? Which is going to be tricky. Sure. But when it comes to, you know, immunology or public health or matters of economic development, like talking to economists and epidemiologists, it seems really, really obvious that that's what we would do. And yet part of what we've watched, and again, this was one of the hanging curveballs that I think we as a society just whiffed on. We watched during COVID a distrust in expertise become normalized as a political loyalty test. And so I wonder, has that made this humility that you are, I think, so admirably trying to live into, which I would suggest any real expert is going to be the most humble about, hey, this is the best we've got given the data we have. Data keeps coming in. We'll keep rethinking. You know, the most humble people I've ever met are the biggest names in the field. Right. It's almost never the kind of like, you know, assistant professor level of folk. It's always the ones who've done this a long time, already have tenure. And they're like, look, this is the best I've got, given what we know at the time. I don't have to convince you that I've got it all figured out. I'm trying to convince you this is the best response, given the relevant options. So has that public distrust caused a kind of epistemic well poisoning that then makes being a political figure modeling humility, like, is that actually come with a political cost?
Right? Oh, well, I think it sure definitely comes with a cost, no doubt. I mean, you know, it's why some of my colleagues, you know, had challengers. I've got an opponent in the November election too, which is also good. It is healthy to have opposition. Yeah. So I want to be clear about that. It's part of the job. But I think it's that thing, right, that people get fixated on one. I do think, Aaron, what's interesting about your question is also sort of this notion that, and especially, I mean, it's at all levels of government because we do have staff, but especially at the national level, but there's been a lot of talk recently about the power of the unelected people in D.C.
Yeah.
And the length of time those people have been there. And, you know, I mean, government is just a different beast than a public company, a private company, a university, a church. I think there's some similarities for sure, but it's definitely different. And I'm wondering if part of that, part of the angst about that had a lot to do with also, it was a time when we were elevating people who were not elected. And so then sort of by default, they were being connected to the people who were the elected people who you either liked or didn't like. So it was just sort of this weird sort of triad of space.
Yeah.
I also think the other challenge certainly was there was such a difference even across the country. I mean, you think about our own state of South Carolina looked very different than some other states in terms of what our local approach was. And I do think that is also the other challenge of this is that, I mean, I say a lot all the time, I mean, all politics are local and really you want the decision-making at the most local point. And I do think there was a definite rub between what you were seeing on the nightly news and what they were saying and in our state, what our governor was saying and what, you know, our mayor was saying. And so I think just there was also just a general like, oh, my God, who am I even supposed to? It's just too much. And so my default is going to be I'm going to shut down and be like, because ultimately also what people want is to have personal responsibility.
Just distrust. Makes sense.
Yeah, that's that distrust that you're talking about. I think that's what I was hinting at or speaking to earlier is just. There is a general kind of erosion in a trust of authority in general. And you know, I say things are understandable, even if they're not justifiable. I think it is understandable that we've not done a great job of sowing a real sense of trust. And part of that is one of the things I think about often with my role and maybe getting at, you know, the question, representing people and having to make decisions that aren't what everybody wants to, you know, agrees with, doesn't match up with everybody's sensibilities. The question for me is really how I assign credibility to anyone and think about it towards myself are the questions of to whom am I accountable or are they accountable and for whom are they responsible? And we have a lot of people, you know, in the kind of culture we've made who really aren't accountable to anyone and don't have a strong sense of connection to the people for whom they're responsible. And I would even say, like, somebody could listen to me on a Sunday or they could listen to our sermon podcast or what have you, and I'm just another voice with another opinion or thought stacking up against anybody else's. And we do have, and I'm on a podcast right now, but we have podcasts and we've had blogs and we've had all these kinds of things. Yeah. And there are plenty of people out there, and you've heard me harp on it a little bit, Aaron, but like, it's kind of the cheap seats and that they are not accountable to anybody for the ideas and things they're putting out there. And they definitely aren't connected to the people for whom they're responsible. There are a lot of people. Yeah. So I'll just talk from my standpoint is there are a lot of people out there pastoring people, so to speak, training, teaching, proclaiming, doing all that stuff, again, without any accountability for what they're saying and not any strong sense of responsibility for what those ideas and thoughts might sow in others. And so it's that larger erosion in general of, like, we want someone to trust and we want to believe that person has our best interest at heart, but gosh, we just have a system that just allows for, as Liz said, I mean, unelected officials to be completely disconnected from the implications of the decisions they're making, and nobody is really holding them accountable. It's kind of what we've made.
Yeah,
I think.
So what do we do? So what do we do? I'm gonna push this one step further, because I can hear questions coming in and comments coming in saying, but wait a minute. When it comes to the loss of trust, there are real, obviously pointable, countable scenarios where that trust is actively undermined. When we are, you know, given false information, when we are continually told that, you know, one person's ego is more important than, you know, all of our social structure and our legal systems, you know, say about particular issues. At what point do we, and this is a question that came in from a guy named Keith up in Grand Rapids, Michigan. At what point do we say there have to be minimum thresholds? And this is dangerous territory, excuse me, because what these minimum thresholds used to be were racist, misogynist, awful, evil requirements. Land owning, you've got to be white, you have to be male. But at what point do we say something like a minimum threshold for being a viable candidate in a democracy is maybe you don't lie all the time. Maybe you are not actively, you know, convicted with felonies. Like maybe there are going to be some sense of what we expect to be reasonable human models, such that, as we talked about a few weeks ago on this podcast, disagreement is necessary for democracy. So, Liz, I love that you say it's important that I get a challenger because it forces me actually to defend the views I think that are the right views. But we can only disagree productively if the epistemic table continues to exist. Right? I can't disagree productively to somebody who says, I won't talk to somebody who goes camping. I'm like, well, I don't know where to go now, right? Or somebody who says, 2 + 2 = 5. Now let's start talking. I'm like, no, you just fail math class. You don't get to have your voice within the space of the conversation. You're just wrong. So in almost every other adult human space, we have minimum thresholds for being a participant, right? If you're going to be a professor, like at Furman, Liz, you got to have a degree that lets that be the thing you do. Now, you can still say stupid stuff. You still might be wrong a lot of the times, but we've got some check. You want to go driving. Well, here, we're going to make sure that you have, you know, the physical capabilities to do this in safe ways. Are you, in fact, blind? Do you require glasses? I took my son, Don't tell Chief Milby over at Furman, but I may have taken my 14-year-old son driving in the parking lots at Furman the other day. Dude ran over a curb and about hit a tree. Like, there are reasons why we don't just say, hey, have a license. You've got to go through steps to be able to do that, right?
Yeah. Are you arguing, Aaron, that there are things that are empirical, in fact? Like,
I'm saying if you want to be a plumber, you've got to get certified. If you want to be a CPA, you have to pass a test. But then when it comes to being some of the most influential, most important humans on earth, just get people terrified, lie to them, all good. Because as long
Aaron, I mean, here's the hard part. A, we're all flawed humans. So we're never going to get the perfect for one. So, I mean, you got to start there. And to your point, there are way more qualifications for voting than to actually be on the ballot. For sure.
That's right.
But I think back to the founders, and, you know, it was about, you know, representative government, go serve your time, come home and go back to work and be a part of your community. And so I think we have just lost that sense of it is a calling, but it's a calling for everyone. So nowhere does it say you're supposed to be in the Senate for 100 years until it's somebody else's term.
Right.
So it'd be interesting to say if we had term limits, would that change the makeup of the people who are there? But then some might argue we have term limits. Every 4 or 6 years, you're at the ballot box. And if you don't like what the person's doing, then vote them out. The problem becomes when there is nobody else on the ballot, or the person on the ballot is worse than the person who's already in there. And you think, well, it's the devil I know, so we might as well just keep that person in there, I think is part of it. And again, I also think it goes back to, you know, just the unfortunate reality is so much of the electorate is just uninformed. People do not know. They don't do their research. They watch a flashy commercial, or they're on Facebook and some ad pops up and, oh, that name sounds good. Or I've seen, or even, I mean, signs is a game in and of itself, right? Every time it get come November and this past June, you drive around, who has the most signs? Who has the biggest signs?
It's taking everything in me, Liz, not to mention one of your colleagues who went sign crazy recently. And he might be one of my neighbors, but like I got to the point where it was almost physically nauseating because I think this human is so vicious as a human, and yet lots of signs wins the election. Like that does it. That's enough. Yeah.
Yep.
Mm.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
So I mean, I don't know what the right answer is, Aaron, but I do, it is hard, but I do think it really just goes back to, it was always meant to be just not just for the aristocrats and the educated. Yeah. It was supposed to be about everyone being able to serve. And it's just, I think maybe devolved a little bit over time. I don't know, Seth, I would love to. You'll have something way more profound to say about it than I.
No.
I want to defer to Steph. I just want to make sure that no one misunderstands. I am not suggesting, because I got called out on Facebook recently for being misunderstood. I do not think that more education is the threshold I'm looking for, right? Like for me, I'm saying like basic humanity. Like, so I do not think holding a PhD makes you better at being a human. It probably makes you more egoist and worse. So my thought about these minimum thresholds, which I'm not even defending, I'm trying to represent what Keith was asking. There seem to be all kinds of things that would get you in trouble in kindergarten, and yet we applaud on the national political stage, right? And so when I say threshold, I just want to make sure I am not saying elitist, academic, intellectual. Mm-hmm. Just the like, don't be a jerk. Or as my buddy Aaron James would say, like, why is it we keep electing assholes? It seems like we could do better. So I make that point. Seth, what do you think?
It's just it's performance. It's just, I mean, I hate to say it, but I just think so much about virtually every sector of our society is driven by an entertainment factor, a performative factor. Like that's what we as Americans, I think, value in many ways above all things. Is like, is this not just interesting? Is it entertaining? People might say, again, that's another, it's just another expression of the stage of capitalism we're in. Also, you know, it's a form of decadence. And I think that we're kind of going there. I mean, it's, and the other scary part about it is, I think, and Liz, I'd be interested in your thoughts on this, but America is still, I guess, you know, to a degree young. And I think there's just a lot of immaturity in our system in general. And we're like, well, why can't we be like this, you know, England or some of these other European nations or others for that matter, at democracies. And I think there's our immaturity was sort of baked in the beginning, and it's sort of, you know, beginning to show. We're tasting it in different ways. And it's a lot of, and I don't even say even sort of what was lying under the American Revolution, but still there was a sense in which we were definitely about what we were against, not what we're for. I think there was a lot of that in it. And so it's just chickens are coming home to roost. Maybe it took, you know, 250, 300 years, but that's where I go with this stuff is I think it's kind of always been there and latent, and it's concerning in America. Like, so I'll just speak as a pastor. One of the most informing things for me to think about with regard to the church isn't about, okay, what happened in the 20th century, what's happened in the evangelicalism that used to be about, you know, suffrage and emancipation and all of these kinds of things. Now it's about this whole different political thing. But American Christianity has always been very performative. It's about get out there, and like revivalism is a thing that has shaped imagination such that the idea of kind of the, and I don't want to be too disparaging about this, but like the mega church and the celebrity pastor and the televangelist, that was always baked in. Even before technology made it possible. So it's shallow, I guess is what I'm saying. I hate to say it, but it's shallow. It's immature. It's like a teenager in many ways. And we've come to celebrate what you are, you know, in a lot of ways, what you see. And I think it's the sad part is I think the nuance and the wisdom that Liz is not only representing, but trying to invite people into is it's the exception and not the rule because of our, I don't want to sound like, you know, unpatriotic around America, but we're just so immature.
And we live for soundbite, right? It's the soundbite. It's the 40 character tweet. It's the Instagrammable, whatever. And I think part of the challenge too is even as a candidate, I can't not do all those things. I mean, it is a way to reach people with your message. So on one hand, I would love to say, well, if we all just stop playing the game would go away. I don't think the game's ever going to go away. Yeah. It's just, can we get a different set of rules? Can we finish the Yahtzee, the games, let's start a clean Yahtzee card.
That's right.
And start playing again.
And that's my point. It's just not a new game because of the nature, I think, the unique project in all its great ways and problematic ways that America is and has been. It's really unique for good or ill. And it is sad. And I share what you feel too, Liz. It probably speaks to the previous question we were talking about. But like, there are things you got to do that you have a significant amount of ambivalence about to just continue to try to be helpful, to try to, like for me, I was off of social media and began in 2016, and you might imagine why, but there's also a lot that I missed out on in connection. I mean, I got back on to some degree because so that people, as our church grew, that people could at least know some things about my life when I couldn't personally connect with them and et cetera. And so you just hold these things together. There's a tension there. These are tools, but again, they're just kind of the next iteration of some of what has been true about America for a long time. And it's sad to me. It's really sad to me that it has really significant way it works itself out. It creates some really significant problems and the inability to get the kinds of things done that should be no-brainers. You know?
Well, I think it's incumbent on both parties. I mean, they really need to do a better job of even just, you know, candidate pipeline. I mean, that's part of the other problem too, is just whether it's at the local, state or national level. I mean, it is a hard job, no matter what level you're at. It doesn't pay very well. You've got to be away from your family. You're subject to a lot. You've got to raise a lot of money to even get in the office in the first place. I mean, there's the entry fee is really high. So I get why people don't want to do it. But I mean, I do think it's incumbent on both parties. They've just got to continue to cultivate people that have had the lived experience and who care enough and who want to make a difference so that people across the country, no matter what state you're in, that you have a choice. I mean, I think that's what will make the game better, is if the players themselves elevate to a level where it is a true choice. And gosh, wouldn't it be great if we got to the point that, man, if either candidate won, it would be great. I mean, like that would be the ultimate.
Gosh,
what if both candidates from both parties were awesome? And you're like, well, if my guy doesn't win, but at least the other one's not bad. I can live with the other person.
Imagine
that. Pipe dream.
Well, it's funny. I need to share it with you, Liz. I don't think you've seen this, but I wrote a open letter to Biden back when, after the debate, but before he decided not to continue his campaign. And I tried to get it out as an op-ed, didn't get picked up anywhere. So I threw it on my Substack and said, hey, I want to make this public, because I think we've got to be public about views and show what it looks like to think, you know, in front of people. And I called for a new candidate, but my vision was, let's find a governor, a blue governor from a red state, and then, for what it's worth, an anti-Trump Republican as vice president. And the idea was, because it's not about party ultimately, it's about modeling what it looks like for disagreement to happen even internal to the room, you know, that Hamilton, you know, in the room where it happened, like, mm-hmm. I want to be in the room with the best. Unfortunately, far too often we've trained people to think, unless you're the best in the room, go to a different one. And I tell my students all the time, being the best in the room might just mean that you're playing tennis with 12-year-olds. Like, it probably just means your room sucks. What would it look like if you were in the room with the best? It will almost necessitate the fact that people think you're wrong about some stuff.
Listen, and that's just like ballroom dancing. Really, when I win, the first thing yeah. I hear back is, it's because the winners didn't come to this comp.
Oh,
you know, oh, man. But you have to, like, right? It's not, I mean,
yeah.
It is a thing. You want, I mean, yeah. when I'm doing my dance, yeah. I want to be dancing against the best.
Yeah.
Win, yeah. lose, or and, otherwise. So,
well, and that's, I think, the pipeline, right? Is, you know, part of the pipeline is, and this maybe goes to this threshold question, like, it's raising people up in a pipeline, not to be oppositional and antagonistic, mm-hmm. but to be deliberative, responsive to reasons, evidence seekers, humble, like, and then really to recognize, very, very, very smart people disagree with me about politics, and they mm-hmm. might be right. You know, and I think I've introduced you before, Liz. If I haven't, I'll do it now. As one of my friends who, you know, you and I disagree when it comes to, like, you know, what letters are behind our name politically. And yet I love being friends with you because you make me think I must be missing something, right? Like, I might be wrong, because the way she's articulating this is something I should think through and reflect on and wrestle with. And that's not typically the way it's deployed, right? Mm-hmm. It's mockery and cajoling rather than deliberative engagement. And so this brings mm-hmm. us to the last part I want to think through with you guys before we shift to our five questions about camping. So what do we then do? And I want to throw out something that we talked about a few weeks ago on another episode. A friend of mine named Rob Talese, he's a professor at Vanderbilt University, and he's written the sort of trilogy of books, Sustaining Democracy, Overdoing Democracy, these types of titles. And he suggests something that I find really, really, really compelling. It's the idea that when we go home for Thanksgiving, when you go home for, you know, the holiday break, don't talk politics, right? So A, the first point is, the people you love most recognize that you love them. And so even though you might disagree about important stuff, that doesn't have to be the local site of your resistance, right? The cost is too high if it comes at the cost of your relationship with your family. The second thing that he suggests is, we need to go bowling and have softball leagues and ballroom dancing competitions. Like, if we found ways to do lived practice together, we'd realize the vast majority of us kind of get along with each other. And then there might be occasions where we can say, hey, so that immigration policy, like, I don't understand why you hold the view you hold. But if we open with that, what we're doing is almost entirely creating an antagonism rather than cultivating relationships that make possible real conversations, you know, with a cider after the church league basketball game is over or whatever it might be, right? So what do you think about this idea, the way that we maybe not fix, it's not a silver bullet, but the way that maybe we start moving things back away from the precipice is we live together and do things together that allow us to see each other as reasonable members of a shared community. What do you think, Seth? Does that sound plausible? Where might that miss something? Again, this is Rob's, like, big political theory view is play softball, which I think is brilliant.
Yes. I mean, I really can't Agree more. I mean, I just think that's where life is lived. I think, I think you do need to know people. And I think the idea of a real experiential patience with people that only comes with being with them, you humanize them, you realize and experience the nuance of the people they are. And what you're really doing is kind of like, I mean, maybe this is a dangerous or scandalous sort of example, but you know, the whole idea that sex begins in the kitchen, right? It's like it begins like the beginning of the day and you're connecting, and it's, this is funny. This is the kind of pastor I am, sorry, but like it's,
we're going to get you reelected at all costs, Liz.
for that to work out later, right? In the best possible way, there's a lot of relational stuff that has to go into it. And I think, so whether it's something as, you know, as wonderful as that experience of intimacy and stuff with each other, even the difficult things of having the conversation and of being able to do that and to enjoy each other even in the midst of that means the work that goes in ahead of it. It means the regular stuff of real life. And again, what you're talking to is the fact that I mean, this is as old as humanity, right? We reduce each other. I mean, you go back to the story of Cain and Abel. And really all that Abel represented to his brother Cain is that which it was rivalry, was the thing that he was taking from him, the thing that, you know, you think, how could this be? And it's his own brother and et cetera. But what he saw him as was the one who was taking the sense of honor that he felt that he deserved. And we can reduce people now. It's just, it's human. It's the reason that I would say that we need the good news of Jesus to say, that's not who you are, and that's not who people are.
Yeah.
And so, but again, that is something that has to happen connecting with people. It's not an abstraction. It's like, you know, was it Wittgenstein who talked about the fact that, you know, philosophy or these ideas, they can become their abstractions. And what they do is they remove all the grit, the rough ground, and you get no friction. So that you get no traction and you go nowhere. But like to actually restore the connection and the friction and the relationship itself is how you can catch ground and move forward. We've turned each other into abstractions, right? Just the ideas we represent versus the people we are. So
that's
think
great.
For me, it's also just remembering that we really do agree more than we disagree. And that part of our challenge is that what is loud is what's loud on the ends, on both sides of the aisle. And they're loud, but it's not the majority. The majority of us really, if you just did this little bubble right around the middle, that's where we all sit. And so I think part of it too is, can we come to a place where, like, what's the lowest common denominator that we can agree on and get agreement, and then go take the next step and the next step and the next step, kind of to your point, like, don't start with the top thing, but what are the lower things? And also, I think it's about having a mind space that, for as frustrating or whatever that you find the other side, a person that you're talking to, that it's like, there might be some element of right in what they're saying, something I can learn from. And I think that's the thing too. If you really buy into being a lifelong learner, then our job is, every interaction should be a learning. So I think part of that's, it's about mindset, but ultimately it's remembering that we really do agree on way more than we disagree on.
It's interesting. Rob Talese,
except for Florida State football. I'm just going to have to say that.
Now you are showing your clear ignorance and vice.
Well, my dad went to Notre Dame, so.
Oh, that's horrible.
Yeah. I probably should have led with that.
Well, Talese says, just to echo your point and bring this kind of serious part of the conversation to a close, Talese and another guy named Scott Aiken, who was actually on the podcast a couple weeks ago, they argue that though there is deep disagreement about things like religion and politics, right? And in fact, the more serious the issue, the deeper the disagreement can go, because it affects who we are, not just, you know, a peripheral belief about how far Walmart is from the local QT station or something. But they say that there is no, and this is a contentious claim, there is no absolutely deep disagreement. And the reason that there's no absolutely deep disagreement is because we share the human condition. We are still the kinds of beings who hold beliefs. And if we hold beliefs, that means that we tacitly think that the beliefs we hold are supported by good reasons. And if we think they're supported by good reasons, we should then be committed to actively creating social structures that allow us to weigh and consider and test those beliefs against objections. This is just part of who we are as a species. Unfortunately, we tend, I think this is your social media point, we tend to isolate and echo chamber ourselves and circle the wagons and be self-protective, rather than living into the expectations of a shared human condition being that kind of ultimate foundation from which we begin to be political beings, right?
Yeah.
Well, you guys both absolutely rocked my face. This has been super fun. Seth, there might be a shirt coming your way, or maybe even a sign, you know, in Liz's honor, that just says, "The Village Church, where sex starts in the kitchen." So I'm convinced numbers will skyrocket. We have hit your marketing campaign.
I mean, I'll come and check it out.
All right. Right?
This is so please in, do. Man. Yeah. On brand.
Or it's your youth group theme, one or the other.
What's that?
Youth group theme.
All right. So we're going to close out tonight doing what we do with every guest on every episode. I have five questions about camping. And for what it's worth, my version of playing softball or, you know, hanging out at the mall or ballroom dancing is getting on the trails, hopping on the bike, grabbing the trout rod. Like, this is the space where I find, I think, my own humanity and real solidarity with the human condition, because it allows me to embrace vulnerability. It allows me to embrace risk. All things, by the way, watch this plug, Liz. All things that I talk about in my recent book, Camping with Kierkegaard. Make sure you grab a copy today. See, this is where we sell our souls and make sure that they're aware of the brand. But when we go camping.
Man, I was looking for the man.
Five questions to both of you. Liz, we'll start with you. So you have to pick beach or mountains.
Beach.
Well, why?
Because I'm more of a warm weather person than a cold weather person, ultimately. And while I do enjoy the mountains and the lake, we were just there a couple weekends ago in Georgia. Beach. Mm-hmm. I love walking the beach. I love the hot weather. So
this is modeling how real disagreement can exist in the context of genuine love. My wife is a beach all day long. She thinks that like having to wear shoes is kind of a horrible way to navigate adulthood. I find the beach to be nothing other than a reminder of working construction in high school and college. Why would I want to be hot and sweaty on purpose? That just sounds awful to me. So, but I get it. And yeah. Seth, I know you are a surfer. You're also a mountain biker. So beach or mountains, man.
Mountains in the winter, beach in the summer.
That's two answers. I think it's two answers.
Gosh. You know, I'm probably going to say beach. There is something about, it does something different in my sense of well-being, just the salt, salt air and all that. So I'll go with beach.
All right. Well, our friendship is going to hit a rough patch, but that's okay. We'll work through it. So number two, whether at the beach or in the mountains, it is possible to camp. And so you're sitting around the campfire. What's your drink of choice? Hot chocolate, hot tea, or coffee? Seth, start with you.
It has to be one of those three. Coffee.
Yeah. All right. Liz?
I'm going to say a mocha, which is technically one answer, but it's a combo of two things.
Okay. I've got some hot chocolate left. Fill me up with some Joe and you end up with your mocha. Mm-hmm. I like that. Mm-hmm. Okay. I will say, because my hunch is this is probably an answer that you would find a lot of solidarity with. I have had two guests who have said, I refuse to pick one of those three. I'll take wine. So that might be the fourth option I have to start introducing. All right, number three, sitting by the campfire, drinking your mocha or your coffee, what is your favorite campfire food other than s'mores? Liz.
Oh, hot dog.
That's such a good answer. It's a classic, yeah. Right? It's always better over the fire.
It's absolutely always better over the fire.
What do you think?
Yeah. Gosh. Yeah, it's probably going to be a hot dog.
But the three of us can go camping because together.
I'm restricted. You know, I can have a hot dog camping on a holiday or at a ball game. Other than that, I don't get them around my house. My wife is not, she doesn't allow me the hot dogs.
Well, yeah. That's a shame. My wife and I have not eaten beef or pork in about a decade. So we eat turkey dogs, but as I have said a couple times, turkey dogs are not as good as quote unquote real hot dogs, but they still taste better over a fire. So
yeah,
it still works for me. All right. Number four. I know, Liz, that you dance. I don't actually know. Are you a musician as well? Okay, so this will work fine then. You're a musician sitting by the campfire. Somebody hands you the piano or organ or guitar or whatever you play. What song is your campfire song go-to?
Oh, my gosh. I don't know. First of all, because my instrument is a piano, so it's really not very portable. Although I can sing, I'm trying to go back to like my Girl Scout days because that was the only time I've ever actually camped outside overnight. And I like,
you got to fix this.
Seth, give me a song. What's your song?
Seth, we'll jump to you. What song will you play? You got your bass out, so it's a cappella, baritone, and bass. What are you singing, Seth?
Gosh. That really is a tough question. I don't know. My son just met Art Garfunkel a couple of weeks ago when we were in New York, surprisingly. So maybe it's going to be any Simon and Garfunkel song.
I could get behind that.
Too pithy, probably, but like Bridge Over Troubled Water. I did a deep dive after I heard that he met him, and I listened to that song. I was like, no, okay, that stuff's actually really great. So. Maybe something like
John
that.
Denver taking home country roads. Like, I don't know. Aaron, yes. what's your answer to this question?
It depends by week. Tonight I'm actually feeling, so I just wrote this essay on my Substack. So for all of you watching, I do have a Substack. I post twice a week. Would love for you to come join me. It's called Philosophy in the Wild. But on Mondays for paid subscribers, I do a post called Music Mondays, where I think philosophically about some musical genre or track or whatever. And this week I was talking about gospel music and the music of Kirk Franklin in particular. And so I actually think there is a kind of gospel soul sort of interface that really does work at the campfire, but it requires that more than one person can sing and everybody there can just hit thirds and fifths and harmonies without having to like try. So if I'm going camping with a bunch of you singers, I think Kirk Franklin's Melodies from Heaven would be an absolute bomb song by the campfire. I think that would be fantastic. So I'm feeling Kirk Franklin this week a little bit. So I think that's where I'd land. Last question.
Verbal, interjections that he does, like you let them sing.
See,
you do the
because
verbal.
I don't sing, right? I'll just sit in my camp chair and just grunt and say various things like anticipating the next line. I say melodies, and then you guys come into it. That'll
right.
be my role. I'm down for that. So, last question. Normally the question is, what philosopher would you take camping with you? But I'm going to change it up tonight. In honor of our conversation about God and politics, what person who has held some sort of public or political office, either alive now or in history, would you take camping with you? So public figure, politician, who would you want to sit by the campfire with? We'll start with you, Liz, since I'm sure you've got your hero politicians in mind.
I'm going to go with Ronald Reagan.
Nice. He is my father-in-law's hero. My father-in-law, Lon Vaughn, is a huge Reagan fan. I disagree with a lot of the policies, but I appreciate the admiration and think that would be a really cool conversation, especially if you can get him talking about like his time in Hollywood. right? I would lean there for the conversational direction, but sounds good.
I might
go
somewhere different, but I get you on that. That might be our lead in as we're, you know.
Okay. Seth, who would you take?
So it has to be somebody that has a political or
just no, just like a public figure. Yeah, just somebody who's done the public work of the stuff we've talked about tonight.
Yeah. Maybe Abraham Kuyper.
Ooh, interesting. Interesting.
Or
a little Dutch reform.
Or Winston Churchill. Yeah. Well, just Kuyper primarily because of just trying to simply engage, you know, the idea of what it looks like faithful presence for the church while also taking very, very seriously the diversity of a society. I thought he did a really great job. Some of that. I don't know.
Yeah.
But Churchill's always a great.
Yeah, Churchill's, it's got to be fun, right? Like just the stories. And I think Reagan and Churchill, and of course, Liz and Seth, like that would be a heck of a conversation. So I would be fine to be a fly on that wall. I think mine tonight would actually be somebody, again, public figure. In this case, I'm going to lean into the religious public figure thing for a second. I actually would like to hang out with William Seymour, who was one of the leaders, founders of the modern Pentecostal movement, was the founder of the Azusa Street Revival back in 1906. But the reason I would like to hang out with him at this space, again, he's a public figure, but, you know, in lots of interesting ways. But he was also an African-American in the time where his religious tradition wanted very little to do with that. And so, in fact, had to sit in the hallway at his seminary, the Bible college, because Black folk weren't allowed in the actual room. And somehow in the context of that, you know, he emerges as one of the leading, you know, lights in this movement. Again, disagree with him on some stuff, but really appreciate what he represented. And I would love to pick his brain about what it looks like to do as the contemporary writer Anne Lamott says, quoting, other thinkers that she has read. And I think it was actually her pastor who said this once, that we should live in a way where we don't let them get you to hate them. And that idea, how do I live so I don't let them get me to hate them? I'd love to hang out with William Seymour and talk about that at a campfire. So I think that's my voice tonight. So, well, yeah. Seth, you were going to say something. You took a break.
I wanted to ask Liz while we have an opportunity. I heard a recent definition of leadership, and maybe you've heard of it. I think Ronald Heifetz, and the definition of leadership was disappointing people at a rate they can tolerate. What do you think of that definition, Liz?
I mean, it's probably accurate.
That's awesome.
Yeah. I guess, but man, I'm hoping I'm making people happy more than I'm disappointing them.
Right. But see, Liz,
the point is if it's a rate they can tolerate, then they're actually handling disappointment, and there is some level of happiness. And like, because you're in a position, the reason I ask is you're in a position where, you know, you kind of not giving anybody everything they want, right? So I don't know. I just thought it was kind of helpful.
I love it.
Especially given the tensions we've talked about.
Yeah.
So there's your sign, Liz. Vote for Liz, disappointing people at a rate they can tolerate since 2008, right? Like you've even got kind of an adjacent rhyme. I think we have got some propulsion, some jet fuel to the church and your political campaign. Yeah. Absolutely. Thank you both so much for joining me on this episode of Campfire Philosophy with J. Aaron Simmons. To all of you who are watching or listening on Spotify, wherever else the podcast is airing, thank you so much for being part of this. Make sure that you check out the Village Anglican Church here in Greenville, South Carolina, and learn about what Seth's doing over there. Also, check out Liz Simmons' campaign currently to be reelected to the Greenville County Council, and also make sure that you check out her fundraiser she's doing right now, supporting the Cancer Survivors Park. And finally, if you are someone who enjoys doing philosophy in this sort of public way, please do get connected with me. My website is jaaronsimmons.com, or you can go to my Substack, Philosophy in the Wild. And while you're out there just clicking links, make sure you go get a copy of Camping with Kierkegaard, available now in Audible. So thank you all so, so, so much. We will see you next week. I'm putting together an episode on Christian nationalism, trying to get that locked down. And then we're going to have an episode toward the end of the month where I'm meeting with my friend Aaron James and my friend Nick Riggle, who have written books about surfing and skateboarding and how to be awesome. And so we're going to talk about how to surf, camp, and skate into a meaningful life. So a lot of great things coming here on Campfire Philosophy with Jaaron Simmons. So thank you all again for being with us. We'll see you next time, unless a piano falls on our heads. On the trail, for hiking with me a few miles more, for casting out your line into waters in which we both stand, for dropping in at the top and fist bumping me at the bottom, and for coming camping with me and Kierkegaard. Our time together has been so very worthy of my finitude. I hope it was worthy of yours as well.